We come back this evening to chapter 23 in The Life Divine, Man and the Evolution. When we left, Sri Aurobindo was in the middle of presenting some typical objections to the idea of a spiritual evolution upon Earth. The first that we looked at was the traditional Vedantic objection that there is an essential divinity, it has no need of evolution, no reason, if it decides to manifest, establishing planes of being from matter all the way up to the higher consciousness, that they should be linked in any meaningful way, such that one rises from grade to grade of consciousness, and that if we assign reality to the lower triplicity, matter, life, and mind, there may be no reason for them to evolve beyond what is the current status of the human being, because the Upanishads recognize that the human is the highest living upon earth. So why should there be something to displace the human from his sovereign position? Why should there be a supramental position assigned to a new being? So that would be the Vedantic objection. The scientific is that simply evolution only occurs on the physical plane. There is variance only within patterns laid down by physical law, and there is no necessary sequence leading from matter to life or from life to mind or in any consciousness beyond that. This is the point we had reached. We have a little bit farther to go with his assessment of these arguments before he makes a refutation. So, if it be asked, how then did all these various gradations and types of being come into existence? It can be answered that fundamentally they were manifested in matter by the consciousness force in it, by the power of the real idea building its own significant forms and types for the indwelling spirit's cosmic existence. The practical or physical method might vary considerably in different grades or stages, although a basic similarity of line may be visible. The creative power might use not one, but many processes, or set many forces to act together. In matter, the process is a creation of infinitesimals charged with an immense energy. Their association by design and number, the manifestation of larger infinitesimals on that primary basis, the grouping and association of these together to found the appearance of sensible objects, earth, water, minerals, metals, the whole material kingdom. Now you can hear that there are assonances in this to what his cosmological picture will be, but still, this is part of the argument that's going in the other direction from where Sri Aurobindo is going. But note here that there is something called an infinitesimal, something almost too minute to measure with the mind, that is charged with an energy that, combined with mathematics, constructs this beautiful physical universe. So there is embedded in his language a cosmological picture emerging. He continues, in life also, the consciousness force begins with infinitesimal forms of vegetable life and infinitesimal animalcules. It creates an original plasm and multiplies it, creates the living cell as a unit, creates other kinds of minute biological apparatus like the seed or the gene, uses always the same method of grouping and association so as to build by a various operation various living organisms. A constant creation of types is visible, but that is no indubitable proof of evolution. The types are sometimes distant from each other, sometimes closely similar, sometimes identical in basis but different in detail. All are patterns, and such a variation in patterns with an identical rudimentary basis for all is the sign of a conscious force playing with its own idea and developing by it all kinds of possibilities of creation. Animal species, in coming into birth, may begin with a like rudimentary embryonic or fundamental pattern for all. It may follow out up to a stage certain similarities of development on some or all of its lines. There may, too, be species that are twi-natured, amphibious, intermediate between one type and another. But all this need not mean that the types developed one from another in an evolutionary series. So, again, he's trying to account for the variability of this, or letting this argument attest to why all of these forms can come into being, but that they not be linked in a meaningful evolutionary process. Other forces than hereditary variation have been at work in bringing about the appearance of new characteristics. There are physical forces such as food, light rays, and others that we are only beginning to know. There are surely others which we do not yet know. There are at work invisible life forces and obscure psychological forces. For these subtler powers have to be admitted, even in the physical evolutionary theory, to account for natural selection. If the occult or subconscious energy in some types answers to the need of the environment, in others remains unresponsive and unable to survive, this is clearly the sign of a varying life energy and psychology, of a consciousness and a force other than the physical at work making for variation in nature. The problem of the method of operation is still too full of obscure and unknown factors for any at present possible structure of theory to be definitive. So yes, we can't explain in detail the process of evolution, even at the physical level. But we can see thumbprints, fingerprints of a conscious being working its way out through the process. So even as he's making the counter-argument, he's slipping in some of his own arguments to undermine theirs as it goes. Man is a type among many types so constructed. One pattern among the multitude of patterns in the manifestation in matter. He is the most complex that has been created, the richest in content of consciousness, and the curious ingeniousness of his building. He is the head of the earthly creation, but he does not exceed it. Even as others, so he too has his own native law, limits, special kind of existence, swabhava, swadharma. Within those limits, he can extend and develop, but he cannot go outside them. So again, he's still arguing here from the traditional interpretation of Vedanta. Let's revisit these two important Sanskrit words, swabhava, swadharma. Swabhava, own being. Swadharma, own law of action. So swadharma is posited on the true being of the person. So what is essential is this swabhava. It is your unique nature, your essential being, which then throws itself out in the world in patterns of action according to a law of being which is consonant with that swabhava. Swadharma must be consonant with swabhava. Swabhava is prior. Swadharma develops from it. So he then says, if there is a perfection to which he has to arrive, it must be a perfection in its own kind, within his own law of being, swabhava. The full play of it, but by observation of its mode and measure, not by transcendence. To exceed himself, to grow into the Superman, to put on the nature and capacities of a god, would be a contradiction of his self-law, impracticable, and impossible. And that's swadharma. Sri Aurobindo will not ultimately agree with this restricted interpretation of what swadharma and swabhava mean. But he accepts that this is their traditional position. Each form and way of being has its own appropriate way of the delight of being. To seek through the mind the mastery and use and enjoyment of the environment of which he is capable is rightly man, the mental being's objective. But to look beyond, to run after an ulterior object or aim of existence, to aspire to surpass the mental stature is to bring in a teleological element into existence which is not visible in the cosmic structure. That's where traditional Vedanta says stop. Yes, you can go and try to find the delight that's natural to your state of being as it works in the world. But you may not evolve into a next grade of being. That is not permitted in the traditional view. He continues, and we'll get to the teleological element in just a moment. If a supramental being is to appear in the terrestrial creation, it must be a new and independent manifestation. Just as life and mind have manifested in matter, so supermind must manifest there, and the secret conscious energy must create the necessary patterns for this new grade of its potencies. But there is no sign of any such intention in the operations of nature. In other words, Vedanta will admit it if it is imposed from this chit shakti. But it cannot be something that develops out of an inferior being then into a superior being. It cannot be linked. So there is no linking of grades to achieve the end of a conscious evolution in the traditional view. He continues now, but if a superior creation is intended, then certainly it is not out of man that the new grade, type, or pattern can develop. For in that case, there would be some race or kind or make of human beings that has already the material of the Superman in it, just as the peculiar animal being that developed into humanity had the essential elements of human nature already potential or present in it. There is no such race, kind, or type. At most, there are only spiritualized mental beings who are seeking to escape out of the terrestrial creation. In other words, the Vedantist casts his eyes about and sees no presence of any such spiritual creature ready to evolve into the supramental. What we find is a few extraordinary exalted types of humanity who are ready to reach out and find an exit from this universe and to attain perfection in that way, by exclusion of the universe and of personhood from their being. If by any occult law of nature such a human development of the supramental being is intended, it could only be by a few in humanity detaching themselves from the race so as to become a first foundation for this new pattern of being. There is no reason to suppose that the whole race could develop this perfection. It cannot be a possibility generalized in the human creature. Now, this is an actual element of his thought, and we'll find this out in succeeding chapters. He is not discarding every possible objection that the Vedantist offers, but he is going to insist on the linking of the grades of existence in an upward arcing evolution, not in the utter and sudden transformation of all of humanity into supramental creatures. He continues now, if indeed man has evolved in nature out of the animal, yet now we see that no other animal type shows any signs of an evolution beyond itself. If then there was this evolutionary stress in the animal kingdom, it must have sunk back into quiescence as soon as the object was fulfilled by man's appearance. So too, if there is any such stress for a new step in evolution, for self-exceeding, it is likely to subside into quiescence as soon as its object is fulfilled by the supramental being's appearance. So in other words, there is no urgent, stressful movement forward in evolution as we see it, as we observe the earth. Where did it go? Well, actually, it is only in the last couple of years that evolutionary biologists have been able to point to dynamic examples of actual change going on here and now. This was a view back in the 1930s that evolution proceeded and then sort of stalled out, that there was no apparent progress of evolution. So it seemed to have had an upward arc and then just quit. So Sri Aurobindo is working with the thinking that was available then. He continues, but there is no such stress in reality. The idea of human progress itself is very probably an illusion, for there is no sign that man, once emerged from the animal stage, has radically progressed during his race history. At most, he has advanced in knowledge of the physical world, in science, in the handling of his surroundings, in his purely external and utilitarian use of the secret laws of nature. But otherwise, he is what he always was in the early beginnings of civilization. He continues to manifest the same capacities, the same qualities and defects, the same efforts, blunders, achievements, frustrations. If progress there has been, it is in a circle, at most perhaps in a widening circle. So here we have the idea of a possible description of progress, but it is with a cyclic worldview. It goes around and around and around, but never upwards. Man today, he says, is not wiser than the ancient seers and sages and thinkers, not more spiritual than the great seekers of old, the first mighty mystics, not superior in arts and crafts to the ancient artists and craftsmen. The old races that have disappeared showed as potent an intrinsic originality, invention, capacity of dealing with life, and if modern man in this respect has gone a little farther, not by any essential progress, but in degree, scope, abundance, it is because he has inherited the achievements of his forerunners. Like Newton saying that I am standing on the shoulders of giants to have reached this height. Nothing warrants the idea that he will ever hew his way out of the half-knowledge, half-ignorance, which is the stamp of his kind, or even if he develops a higher knowledge, that he can break out of the utmost boundary of the mental circle. So locked within a certain orbit, not able to escape it. When he says maybe the circle is wider, he means that maybe more are included. The enlargement of the circle means that we have not only Plato now who can think, but a number of people who have been trained to think like Plato. So Plato multiplied, but no one elevated above the rank and type of the human. That's his point. It is tempting and not illogical to regard rebirth as the potential means of a spiritual evolution, the factor that makes it possible. But still, it is not certain, granting rebirth to be a fact, that this is its significance. This, again, is the classic Hindu view of rebirth. This is not his argument. All the ancient theories about reincarnation supposed it to be a constant transmigration of the soul from animal to human, but also from human to animal bodies. The Indian idea added the explanation of karma, of a return for good or evil done, of a result of past will and effort, but there was no suggestion of a progressive evolution from type to higher type, still less of birth into a kind of being that has never yet existed but has still to evolve in the future. This is quite true. If you look at the thrust of spiritual thinking in India, Sri Aurobindo's views are unique, that there would be an evolution of consciousness from form to form, out of matter into life, into mind and beyond mind, using rebirth as a machinery, as a way to achieve this, because too much to do in one life, no? It is alone in its view of this, but it is alone in its satisfying explanation of what is the purpose of this world. He continues, if evolution there is, then man is the last stage, because through him there can be the rejection of terrestrial or embodied life and an escape into some heaven or nirvana. That was the end envisaged by the ancient theories. And since this is fundamentally and unchangeably a world of ignorance, even if all cosmic existence is not in its nature a state of ignorance, that escape is likely to be the true end of the cycle. So if you want to get rid of this ignorant world, you have to attain moksha. And if you can do that through this series of rebirths, well and good, it's your way out. Even if ignorance is primarily deposited upon earth and doesn't exist in the higher worlds, which are still part of cosmic nature, he's suggesting, the best way to get out of it is to escape it and to quit the world. This was the typical view of Vedanta leading into this last century. That's the end of that argument. Now he responds. This is a line of reasoning that has a considerable cogency and importance, and it was necessary to state it, even if too briefly, for its importance, in order to meet it. For although some of its propositions are valid, its view of things is not complete and its cogency is not conclusive. And first, we may, without much difficulty, get rid of the objection to the teleological element, which the idea of a predetermined evolution from inconscience to superconscience, the development of a rising order of beings with a culminating transition from the life of the ignorance to a life in the knowledge, brings into the structure of the terrestrial existence. The objection to a teleological cosmos can be based on two very different grounds. Let's pause for a moment. Teleological, just to go back and look at it again, is from the Greek word telos, which means end, aim, or purpose. So what's teleological is what's dealing with the final causes, the real causes of things, and their purpose. So a teleological universe is a purposeful universe. There's a point, there's an aim ingrained in the cosmos, which is trying to work its way out. Others say, no, there is no teleological purpose, and this is what Sri Aurobindo is objecting to here. So let's start that sentence again. The objection to a teleological cosmos can be based on two very different grounds. A scientific reasoning proceeding on the assumption that all is the work of an inconscient energy, which acts automatically by mechanical processes and can have no element of purpose in it. And a metaphysical reasoning, which proceeds on the perception that the infinite and universal has everything in it already, that it cannot have something unaccomplished to accomplish, something to add to itself, to work out, to realize, and there can therefore be in it no element of progress, no original or emergent purpose. So the first view is scientific, the second view is again traditional Vedantic. The scientific or materialist objection cannot maintain its validity if there is a secret consciousness in or behind the apparently inconscient energy and matter. Even in the inconscient, there seems to be at least an urge of inherent necessity producing the evolution of forms, and in the forms a developing consciousness, and it may well be held that this urge is the evolutionary will of a secret conscious being and its push as progressive manifestation, the evidence of an innate intention in the evolution. This is a teleological element, and it is not irrational to admit it. For the conscious or even the inconscient nisus arises from a truth of conscious being that has become dynamic and set out to fulfill itself in an automatic process of material nature. the teleology, the element of purpose in the nisus, is the translation of self-operative truth of being into terms of self-effective willpower of that being. And if consciousness is there, such a willpower must also be there, and the translation is normal and inevitable. Truth of being, inevitably fulfilling itself, would be the fundamental fact of the evolution, but will and its purpose must be there as part of the instrumentation, as an element in the operative principle. So, his argument is that, given that there is an inconscient ground to this cosmos, the fact that out of matter consciousness begins to appear might very well mean that the appearance of consciousness is intentional, that it is willed, that it's part of the purpose of the cosmos to reveal this embedded truth of being, that consciousness must rise out of inconsciousness. So what do we have here in the closing sentences? Truth of being, sat, an effective willpower. This is akin to chit tapas. And if this truth of being, if this sat wants to apply its will, its own conscious power, then there is a purpose to it and is self-effectuating through the cosmic machinery. So sat, chit, and presumably ananda are all working here secretly in the world. And when you can perceive and commune and work with this emerging reality and consciousness and delight, then you're in the swim of things and the cosmos becomes friendly to you and you work in collaboration with the world in developing a new consciousness. So he's argued against the scientific constriction. Now he has to take up the metaphysical. By the way, nisus is a word that means effort, striving, impulse, that which wants to move forward. The metaphysical objection is more serious, for it seems self-evident that the absolute can have no purpose in manifestation except the delight of manifestation itself. An evolutionary movement in matter as part of the manifestation must fall within this universal statement. It can be there only for the delight of the unfolding, the progressive execution, the objectless, serried self-revelation. A universal totality may also be considered as something complete in itself. As a totality, it has nothing to gain or to add to its fullness of being. But here, the material world is not an integral totality. It is part of a whole, a grade in a gradation. It may admit in it, therefore, not only the presence of undeveloped immaterial principles or powers belonging to the whole that are involved within its matter, but also a descent into it of the same powers from the higher gradations of the system to deliver their kindred movements here from the strictness of a material limitation. So there is both a descent from above of kindred elements, mind, life, subtle matter, and an emergence from below through the coils of evolution. A manifestation of the greater powers of existence till the whole being is manifest in the material world in the terms of a higher, a spiritual creation, may be considered as the teleology of the evolution. This teleology does not bring in any factor that does not belong to the totality. It proposes only the realization of the totality in the part. There can be no objection to the admission of a teleological factor in a part movement of the universal totality if the purpose, not a purpose in the human sense, but the urge of an intrinsic truth, necessity, conscious in the will of the indwelling spirit, the nisus, in other words, is the perfect manifestation there of all the possibilities inherent in the total movement. So there is a point to reach in the delightful drama. All exists here, no doubt, for the delight of existence. All is a game or lila. But a game, too, carries within itself an object to be accomplished, and without the fulfillment of that object would have no completeness or significance. A drama without denouement may be an artistic possibility, existing only for the pleasure of watching the characters and the pleasure in problems posed without a solution or with a forever suspended dubious balance of solution. The drama of the earth evolution might conceivably be of that character, but an intended or inherently predetermined denouement is also, and more convincingly possible. Ananda is the secret principle of all being and the support of all activity of being. But Ananda does not exclude a delight in the working out of a truth inherent in being, immanent in the force or will of being, upheld in the hidden self-awareness of its consciousness force, which is the dynamic and executive agent of all its activities and the knower of their significance. So this is the meaning of This is the meaning of Satchit Ananda embedded in the universe and revealed in time through the process of evolution. So his argument is that these are not segregated planes of being. The infinite is a transcendence, no doubt, but it posits itself as a universal being. And in that universal being, all these elements are immanent. They are all within it. And so it is only natural that they would emerge through the process of evolution, because that secret consciousness embedded and underneath the inconscience expresses itself relentlessly, and this nisus, this forward tip of evolution, continues to work its way out, perhaps not in the linear manner. Perhaps it is spiraling, but it is certainly not simply revolving and circular and cyclic. So there is nothing in this view of evolution that he's proposing that violates the cardinal attributes of the divine as seen by Vedanta. We just need to see it in a more complex way, in a more sophisticated way, and we'll see that his view is completely consolidated, harmonious, within the whole of the Vedantic system. Not Advaita Vedanta, but all the way back to the original Vedanta of the Upanishads. So I think that's a good place to end for this evening, and we'll take up another section of the 23rd chapter next time. So tonight we can read from Savitri, choosing a passage from Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Life. Elements of these passages, I think, are relevant to what we've been reading. Then dawned a greater seeking, broadened sky, a journey under wings of brooding force. First came the kingdom of the morning star. A twilight beauty trembled under its spear, and the throb of promise of a wider life. Then slowly rose a great and doubting sun, and in its light she made of self a world. A spirit was there that sought for its own deep self, yet was content with fragments pushed in front, and parts of living that belied the whole, but pieced together might one day be true. Yet something seemed to be achieved at last. A growing volume of the will to be, a text of living and a graph of force, a script of acts, a song of conscious forms, burdened with meanings fugitive from thought's grasp, and crowded with undertones of life's rhythmic cry, could write itself on the hearts of living things. In an outbreak of the might of secret spirit, in life and matter's answer of delight, some face of deathless beauty could be caught, that gave immortality to a moment's joy, some word that could incarnate highest truth, leaped out from a chance tension of the soul, some hue of the absolute could fall on life, some glory of knowledge and intuitive sight, some passion of the rapturous heart of love. A hierophant of the bodiless secrecy, interned in an unseen spiritual sheath, the will that pushes sense beyond its scope to feel the light and joy intangible, half found its way into the ineffable's peace, half captured a sealed sweetness of desire that yearned from a bosom of mysterious bliss, half manifested veiled reality. A soul not wrapped into its cloak of mind could glimpse the true sense of a world of forms, illumined by a vision in the thought, upbuoyed by the heart's understanding flame. It could hold in the conscious ether of the spirit the divinity of a symbol universe. So I think we'll close there. Namaste. Jai Ma.